From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. On Wednesday, a judge is to start hearing lawyers' arguments in the trial of six Baltimore police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. We asked two criminal law professors what motions are before the judge and what impact they might have. Then, in this month's installment of Living Questions, Tom Hall visits the Carmelite Monastery in Towson, the oldest community of religious women in the U.S., and speaks with Sister Constance Fitzgerald about the impact a life of reflection and prayer can have in a troubled world. Plus, theater critic J. Wen Russick reviews an 18th century Italian comedy in an 18th century tavern in Annapolis. And Paula Willey, our recurring advisor on books for young readers, talks with Tom about books kids can listen to. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Hearings in the trial of six Baltimore police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray begin Wednesday. Mayor Rawlings Blake said a few days ago that city officials know that an unpopular ruling by the judge could be a flashpoint for protests, and the city is preparing for that possibility. The pretrial motions will be argued before Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams in two sessions, on Wednesday and a week from Thursday, September 10th. Among the defense motions is one to move the trial out of Baltimore, and some to remove Baltimore State's attorney from prosecuting the case. Judge Williams already has ruled on some motions. Last week, he rejected a subpoena by the defense lawyers for the prosecutors to take the witness stand at Wednesday's hearing. Here to catch us up on what's at stake on Wednesday and next Thursday is David Jaros, law professor at the University of Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Doug Colbert, law professor from the University of Maryland. Welcome.
Thank you, Sheila.
So, David Jaros, what are the biggest issues on the table for the hearings on Wednesday and next Thursday?
I think the biggest issue coming up is what will be resolved at the second hearing, this venue question, whether or not this case is tried here in Baltimore, or whether or not the judge concludes that the defendants can't get a fair and impartial jury here in Baltimore and then moves the case outside of the city.
And the defense has argued to move it.
The defense has argued that they cannot get a fair and impartial jury here in the city, and that the prosecution has responded that actually the voir dire process should prove sufficient.
The voir dire is the process of choosing a jury.
Yes, the voir dire process is the process in which we choose a jury. The judge can ask questions of the jurors, make sure that they haven't seen too much of the prejudged a lot of the issues, and can ask about what kind of media they've been exposed to. And the prosecutor's position is that after that voir dire process, there's good reason to think they can get a fair and impartial jury. And if not, we'll know at that point, and then the venue decision could be brought up then.
Doug Colbert, tell me something about what the standard is for making that decision about whether a venue should be changed.
Well, the defense must show that there's some credible evidence to conclude that someone would not likely receive a fair and impartial trial. And the defense strategy from the very beginning of this case, from the moment that there was a charge and an arrest of these officers, has been to move the case outside of Baltimore City and to remove Ms. Mosby from the prosecution itself. No doubt it came as a real surprise and shock to the police union that there would be a local prosecutor here in Baltimore that would charge police officers with very serious crimes, homicide, and serious felonies. Miss Mosby, after all, was the candidate of the police union whom mm-hmm. they supported. And so once the shock and surprise wore off, right away the union lawyer was saying that, in so many words, that we cannot get a fair trial here in Baltimore. I think from that moment forward, every effort has been made by both the defendants and the union to try to convince a judge that the local community would not be able to provide a fair trial.
And the standard is that they, that the jurors, that the judge is satisfied that they have not reached a conclusion, not that they don't know about the case.
Absolutely.
Right. And it's a very heavy burden. It's very rare, extraordinarily rare, that you're going to get a change of venue, because what you're really saying is that the local criminal justice system and the local community is not able to pass judgment for a crime which took place in its jurisdiction. It would be a very strong statement against the Baltimore City community.
But David Jarris, all of this discussion about whether there can be a fair trial in Baltimore assumes it will be a jury trial.
It does assume that there will be a jury trial.
Do we know that?
Defendants are free to waive the right to a jury trial, but if they demand a jury trial, they have every right to one.
And what is the timing on when the defendants have to make that decision?
Here in Maryland, at this point, it is the defendant's choice as to whether or not to choose a judge or to choose a jury. And historically, in the rare instances when a police officer has ever been brought to trial, and I should point out that of the 2,700 killings that have taken place in the past decade, where police have killed a civilian
nationally
throughout the country, that of those 2,700 killings, more than 98% of the police officers were never charged with a crime. So this is such a rare event that we're watching unfold in Baltimore, where you have a local prosecutor who has charged and arrested officers and then obtained an indictment. And now the question is, will there be a trial and where will the trial take place? And one of the reasons that the defense would like this case to move outside of Baltimore, and this is also true as a historic fact, is that they would like very much to have a jury which is comprised of as many white jurors as possible. And that's something that can make people uncomfortable, but throughout history, the all-white jury or predominantly white jury has tended to acquit a white defendant and a police officer of a crime against a black person.
To add to that, the background of this case is there is the Rodney King trial, of course, in L.A. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the trial was moved outside of the city to a predominantly white, wealthier neighborhood. And that jury pool was very different than what you would have found in inner city Los Angeles. And that acquittal was a shock to many. And there was, I think, a great deal of anxiety about whether or not the reason for that had to do with the particular makeup of the jury pool. And that is very much, I think, part of the strategy of the defense. I think one has to concede, however, that this is a very difficult issue. There is, on the one side, the right of the community to process and resolve a deep harm and crime that may or may not have happened in their community. And that is incredibly important. At the same time, As a former defense attorney who was a public defender in the Bronx, it is scary to imagine that the jury that is impaneled is one that is concerned about rioting in their very neighborhood and is thinking about their decision and how it will affect the city, and not necessarily entirely focused just on what is the evidence and can we find the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with David Jarros, a law professor at the University of Baltimore, and Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland. We're talking about the court hearing starting on Wednesday to review motions for the Freddie Gray case. The other issue that you identified as perhaps one of the most important is the defense motions to take State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby off the case. What is the defense argument for why the state's attorney should not be the one prosecuting this case?
The defense's argument, I think, on the recusal motion is, in my mind, substantially weaker than the arguments they make in the venue motion, which, again, I think is still a complex issue and not easy to predict how the judge will come out. But the defense sort of threw a whole lot at the wall to see what would stick. To be perfectly honest, I think the motion speaks to a couple things. One, and I talked about it with my students, is the idea that it is an interesting how when you get deeply involved as an attorney in your case, how personal things can become, and the level of vitriol just sort of rises as you get passionate about your clients. The other is, I think, an interesting strategic question if this isn't some of the color that is being added really to the venue motion. So there is this recusal issue going on, but I think if you want to understand what is the critical legal juncture that we're in the case, this is mostly about where will this case be tried rather than who will try it.
And I agree with David in terms of the weakness of this particular motion. I do think it's somewhat disingenuous for the police union to have asked for a special prosecutor at the very beginning of this case when they opposed legislation that would have created the Office of Special Prosecutor in cases such as this one. So it's pretty clear that what the defense would like to do is to remove Ms. Mosby. I think their grounds, if they were to be accepted, would probably jeopardize many other prosecutions because there's really not enough here, in my opinion, to accuse or to show that her misconduct. The latest effort was that she's a potential witness, and because she's a potential witness who investigated this case, that she should not also be prosecuting it. But I agree with David that this is an effort to try to lean towards removing the case from Baltimore on different grounds.
David Jarosz, you talked about many of the things that a judge has to consider in deciding whether to move a trial. And you talked about the possibility of jurors being distracted by the risk of protests. Is the risk of protests something the judge directly considers? Is it appropriate for the judge to say things are going to be smoother if this trial is going on someplace else? Is that something
I don't
he
think that
consider.
Is typically part of the test. The test is really, can the defendants receive a fair trial and as part of that have a jury that is fair and impartial when they come in? They haven't sort of prejudged any of the issues. The concern that a judge could have about the jury is that the jury will have their own concerns about what will be the response, and that could somehow shape how they hear the evidence and sort of predetermine their actions. But I think this is one of those cases that really tests our system. It tests our system because of our dedication that every defendant get a fully fair trial where the evidence is examined in a neutral light. And it tests our ability to try hard cases that involve state workers, the police, and raise sort of dangers of civil unrest and all of those challenges.
Lots more I'd like to ask you, but we are out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Colbert, law professor at the University of Maryland, where he teaches criminal and constitutional courses. He wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun this summer titled Many Obstacles to Prosecuting Police. David Jarosz, professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches courses in criminal law and evidence and criminal procedure. He was also quoted in a recent Baltimore Sun article about the pretrial motions. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, another edition of Tom Hall's Living Questions. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and it's time now for Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Last month, I paid a visit to the Carmelite Monastery on Delaney Valley Road in Towson, where I spoke with Sister Constance Fitzgerald, who has been a Carmelite nun for 64 years. The community of Carmelites who live, work, and pray on their beautiful 26-acre campus have a lineage that extends back 225 years. Founded in 1790 in Charles County, this was the first community of religious women in the 13 colonies. Baltimore Carmel is celebrating their 225th anniversary with a number of events throughout the year, including a seminar that Sister Constance Fitzgerald will co-lead next month. We talked about the contemplative life of the Carmelites and how they balance the values of solitude and personal reflection with the values of community and engagement with the wider world. Sister Connie began by chronicling some of the rich history of the Carmelites in Maryland.
We are the oldest community of religious women in the 13 original colonies, and I believe that what's interesting to reflect on is that religious life for women began with contemplative life. We often think of more active ministries, but it did begin in 1790 at Port Tobacco in southern Maryland with contemplative nuns who were Americans. Differently, again, from many of the more active communities, our sisters came from the oldest families in southern Maryland who had come over on the Ark and the Dove or shortly thereafter. So from our very beginnings, we have been rooted in Maryland. And even though the sisters had gone to Europe and been educated, joined communities in the Low Countries in the middle of the 18th century, when these nuns came back, founding the Carmelites in America, they were Americans returning home.
And from Port Tobacco in Charles County, you eventually made your way to Baltimore and then eventually out here to Towson. How did that all transpire?
Well, we moved in 1831 when Charles County became pretty depressed and the nuns could no longer support themselves on the farm in southern Maryland. So they moved to Asquith Street in 1831 and conducted one of the first schools for young ladies in the country. We lived there for till 1873, moved to Caroline and Biddle Street, where many older Catholics would remember coming to the monastery. And in 1961, we moved out to Delaney Valley to this beautiful property where we are now.
Yes, it is a beautiful property indeed. Let's talk a little bit about what this notion of a contemplative life is. We live in such a hyper-connected world. You know, with the internet, there are folks who are literally connected to what's going on 24/7. You write on your website, and I've seen the Carmelite experience described as hermits in community. What does that mean?
Well, actually, being hermits in community is specifically Carmelite. It grows out of our origins on Mount Carmel in Palestine, but modern-day Israel. So, and we were founded initially as hermits. When St. Teresa reformed the order in the 16th century, she brought into it a more decisive community life. And so we do live lives which stress solitude and stress prayer and stress the eremitical or hermit dimension of life. In other words, solitude to be with God, solitude to seek intimacy with God. But on the other hand, it's very important for us to live together as friends, to cherish one another, and to live in a community where all are equal and all are taken care of, so to speak. So we have here a very strong community life. We are a multi-generational community stretching from 37 years old to 94.
How many Carmelite sisters are there currently? I know one of the tenets of the Carmelite order is that the communities not be larger than 21, I believe.
That's right.
How many do you have now, and why is there a limit of 21?
Well, we have 16 now. We just had a death, so we are now 16. When St. Teresa reformed the order in the 16th century, she felt that unless the community was small, that is, not exceeding, at first she thought 13, but later realized she needed more than that, so not exceeding 21, that was a group where all could really know one another. And I think it's important to realize that this community is not formed just for the consolation of those who live in it. the community is strong and the community is emphasized and the love that binds people together is emphasized because we really believe that this has an effect on the world, that whether one projects goodness and love and friendship onto the currents of human consciousness or whether one projects something less good is important, and that this has an effect on the world.
So that's the value then of this of a contemplative life. You're literally projecting your intimacy with God, your friendship with God through Jesus, trying to project that on the world in a spiritual way. Is that a fair assessment?
That is fair. Yes, I think. And we understand this better today as we know more about human evolution and human energy and the human spirit. We realize that we can put on the currents of human consciousness goodness or evil. And we can actually, by our both union with one another, communion with one another, and also our communion with God, really have an effect in the world. It can have effect on the currents of human consciousness.
There are so many people, religious movements, both in and out of the Catholic, outside of the Catholic Church, that are much more activist, if you will, for lack of a better term. You know, they're running soup kitchens, and they're. What is your? How does the Carmelite life and the Carmelite philosophy fit into that broader picture of people? You know, sort of doing works in the community.
I think that's always a question that people ask us and that we often ask ourselves. Many of the younger women who come and enter our communities come because in the end, after having had careers as maybe nurses or physician's assistants or dentists or doctors or lawyers, and actually working with the poor, they come to the conclusion that they are going to be even more effective for those who are suffering by living a life of prayer, that their lives of reaching for, desiring communion with God will really have an effect in the world, and that by being people of peace, people desiring communion, that this will, in the end, influence the human spirit in a very, very profound way. And so they make a choice for a life like this with exactly that, those questions before them in relation to the poor or the soup kitchen or the city. And we pray every day for the city. I mean, we actually just sat, and we'd never do this, we sat glued to the TV when the riots were going on, just absolutely aching for the city.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. I'm at the Carmelite Monastery in Towson with Sister Constance Fitzgerald, one of the members of the community of the Carmelite Sisters of Baltimore. You're listening to Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Carmelites talk about achieving and working towards an intimacy with God, a friendship with Jesus. What does that mean to you as a person who's been in the Carmelite order for more than 50 years now?
That should be an easy question, Tom, but it never is. It never is an easy question. I think that our spirituality very deeply stresses intimacy with Christ. And we spend our lives striving to grow in the love of Christ and striving to take on a closer and closer identity with Christ. And as I'm talking about it now in some of the things that I'm teaching, I talk about growing into a new relational identity, which is the identity of Jesus Christ and his identity in relation to God, and actually becoming so our lives so entwined with Christ, so connected, so intimately associated with Him, that one really can't separate out who is Christ and who is me, and striving to live in that kind of deep intimacy that takes a lifetime and in which we never totally complete, I guess, until our death.
Sister Connie, it is always a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Tom. It's been good to be with you.
Sister Constance Fitzgerald is a former prioress and currently a formation director of the Carmelite Sisters of Baltimore. They were the first monastery of Carmelite nuns and the oldest community of religious women in the United States. This year, they are celebrating the 225th anniversary. 2015 is also the 500th anniversary of the birth of St. Teresa of Avila. They are celebrating these anniversaries here at their beautiful monastery on Delaney Valley Road in Towson with a number of events. The next one is next month on Saturday, September 19th. Sister Constance Fitzgerald will lead a seminar with the Jesuit priest, Father Brian McDermott. The seminar is entitled Teresian and Ignatian Spiritualities in Conversation. We've got a link to the details on our website, wypr.org/livingquestions. You've been listening to Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere, produced by WYPR in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. You can hear this and the other conversations in our Living Questions series when you visit our website. Again, come to wypr.org/livingquestions. Reporting from the Carmelite Monastery in Towson, I'm Tom Hall.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. It's Monday. That means it's time for our weekly theater review with theater critic Jaywin Russick. She's gone to see the world premiere of Annapolis Shakespeare Company's Servant of Two Masters. The play is adapted by Tim Mooney and will run in the outdoor courtyard at Reynolds Tavern every Tuesday evening until September 29th.
Double dealing, misunderstandings, disappearing funds, important papers lost or shredded, and a little romance. Could be a typical day at any state capital, give or take the romance. You can see it all right before your eyes in historic Annapolis, thanks to Annapolis Shakespeare Company's delightful production of the Commedia dell'arte classic, The Servant of Two Masters. An 18th century Italian comedy might seem an unusual choice for a Shakespeare company, but this comedy is a good fit for its setting, the Reynolds Tavern, which opened in Annapolis in 1747. A year after Carlo Goldoni wrote The Servant of Two Masters. Director Sally Boyette, Annapolis Shakespeare's artistic director, dresses her actors in pre-revolutionary costumes, tri-corner hats for the men, and cotton dresses with fitted bodices and full skirts for the women. Plus, Goldoni's play is about, as the title says, a servant. So what better place to see it than a restaurant, specifically the outdoor courtyard at Reynolds Tavern, where patrons are being served. The title character, a servant named Truffaldino, is constantly hungry.
But here's an inn. You know, I've half a mind to go inside and see if I can find a nibble or a morsel or a bite before I have to tie my belt more tight. But what if he comes looking here for me? Well, that's his problem. You must all agree I have every right to go inside. But wait! I haven't any money. Curse my fate. Why must I be a servant? I'd have made... Oh, yes, that's right. I never learned a trade.
Patrick Truller, as Truffaldino, at times seems too smooth to be this perpetually bumbling servant. A man so famished and in need of funds, he simultaneously hires himself out to two masters, with comic consequences. But Truller is at his funniest when he's handed a bowl of pudding to serve. He takes a taste and then another, throwing his head back in ecstasy, hair flying, in a goofy manner reminiscent of Seinfeld's Kramer. Goldoni's convoluted plot concerns not only Truffaldino's secret dual employment, but also one, two, and eventually three sets of lovers. The third consists of Truffaldino and a maidservant, played by an amorous Amy Pastore. Here he is with the maidservant, trying to make sense of a letter, though neither knows how to read.
There it is, exposed.
So read it fast!
No, you, I must suppose, you know your lady's writing more than me.
In truth, I can't make out a thing I see.
Oh, wait, no, I might just make a go.
There's letters there I think that I might know.
Well, let's give it a shot. Is that an M?
An R.
An R?
It's got a stem.
You mean that thing?
It's Re or Rye or Rio. No, wait, it's M. It's me or my or mio.
Or not so much mio, maybe mia?
A mia.
There's a hook there, you can see a...
It's a mia!
Hey!
Annapolis Shakespeare's production is the world premiere of a swift, lively, rhymed adaptation by Timothy Mooney, a Chicago-based writer. Mooney humorously weaves some modern phrases into the text. For example, "We were to rendezvous in the piazza." That's crazy, that's messed up, I see, I gotcha. Director Boyette lets her cast have fun with some of the near rhymes, deliberately forcing them. She also makes ample use of sound effects, wooden slapsticks, a kazoo, a bicycle horn. And she assigns identifying sound effects to several characters, heard whenever their names are mentioned. The first few notes of the theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly are associated with one character. A tiny ringing bell and swooning women are associated with another. The director has assembled a close-knit cast of 8 actors who keep the tempo and the humor brisk. She and writer Mooney even work some Reynolds Tavern menu items into the script. Baked brie, rockfish, fried green tomatoes. You can enjoy these dishes while you're enjoying The Servant of Two Masters. And trust me, this relatively new Shakespeare company is so carefully honed, you won't be tempted to throw even one tomato.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Servant of Two Masters runs until the end of September on Tuesday nights. She joins Marilyn Morning every Monday morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Coming up, Paula Willey joins Tom Hall to talk about her audiobook suggestions for kids. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now back to the show.
Students in Baltimore County have been back to school for a week. City students begin their school year today. Paula Willey is Marilyn Morning's resident expert on great books for kids, and she joins me this morning to talk about some books that kids may want to dive into as they say goodbye to summer. Paula is a librarian at the Parkville Kearney branch of the Baltimore County Public Library. She's also a library consultant. She writes about books at her blog, Unadulterated, and she is a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. Hey, Paula, good to see you.
Hi, Tom.
Did you have a good summer?
I had a terrific summer.
Good. So we're going to talk about something that folks may think at first blush is sort of apostasy. We're going to talk about audiobooks for kids. Is it a good idea for kids to listen to books instead of reading them?
Well, it is a fantastic idea for kids to listen to audiobooks. Instead of reading is not where you want to go with it. But in addition to reading print, audiobooks help develop reading skills that are not necessarily about decoding and learning the alphabet and learning how words are put together. Audiobooks help with vocabulary, comprehension, fluency, and pronunciation.
So when you buy an audiobook, you get a CD or you get a download. Do you also have the option of reading along with the audiobook?
You always have the option of reading along with the audiobook. And some research says that it's very good, especially for kids who have processing issues or learning disabilities related to reading.
So what would a processing issue be, for example?
That is reading and not taking a while to decode what the words are on the page. So the listening and reading at the same time gives additional clues for meaning.
Mm-hmm. But when they're just listening, mm-hmm. you know, if they're in the car or if they're in bed, you know, before they're going to sleep or something like that, they're still using that same part of their brain to imagine what the scene looks like, to imagine what the character looks like and how she's talking, et cetera. I mean, they're using the same skills as they would use were they actually reading the text.
Right? And in some cases, more so, because a kid can comprehend a book at least two grade levels above what they can read. So mm-hmm. especially for a developing reader who is stuck with, you know, what we used to call Dick and Jane books, they can listen to something that's much more complex, that has multiple points of view, that has flashbacks, and they're developing critical thinking facilities. They're developing the ability to make connections, and they boost the auditory stamina and focus. Hmm. So that means, you know, as you get older and in school, a lot you're receiving a lot of your information in an auditory way anyway. You're sitting there listening to lectures. So if you have developed your ability to focus on receiving information through your ears, then you are way ahead when it comes to taking notes in class.
Good skill to have. What's your take on this? When my daughter was young and my wife and I would read to her, I would do voices, you mm-hmm. know, different characters and stuff. And she always bristled at that. She'd say, no, Daddy, just read it. I mean, that was a weird thing for her. What do you recommend to parents? And what's your experience as a children's librarian? Do kids like that, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, they do. Maybe you weren't very good at it.
I probably wasn't. You
know? No, they do. And the best audiobook narrators, in fact, there's a book called Skullduggery Pleasant. It's a long series, and we listened to the first one on audio, and the narrator can talk like this. He could talk like Skullduggery Pleasant. And then I would try to read the next books, and my kids were like, you're not doing it right.
Yeah. Right. Are most books for children available as audiobooks? It seems that almost every, you know, big work of fiction and even nonfiction these days is published in an audio version.
Yeah. To a certain extent, we're seeing audio versions of most of the books that come out from the major publishers. Not only that, but children's books are more likely to get a narrator who is somebody you might have heard of, strangely. Mm-hmm. So you'll have, you know, famous actors reading these books.
Yeah, we have an example of that. Mm-hmm. Here's Kate Winslet, and she's reading Matilda, famous book by Raoul Dahl. And when you go to that page on a place like Amazon or the Ivy Bookshop or something, you see, you know, 12 other titles of Raoul Dahl mm-hmm. also available on audiobooks. Here's Kate Winslet reading Matilda.
Some parents go further. They become so blinded by adoration, they manage to convince themselves their child has qualities of genius. Well, there is nothing very wrong with all this. It's the way of the world. It is only when the parents begin telling us about the brilliance of their own revolting offspring that we start shouting, "Bring us a basin! We're going to be sick!"
There's another one that you've brought this morning that has what you would call a culturally accurate voice. I found this one really interesting. Malala,
right.
Yousafzai, has a book, autobiography, I Am Malala, How One Girl Stood Up for Education and Changed the World. She's, of course, the youngest person ever to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's not Malala reading the book, but it is another Pakistani woman. I guess there are a lot of books like this that also, you know, have voices that are culturally accurate. So for those kids from those cultures, it's important for them.
Well, it both ways. For kids from those cultures, it's great to hear a story read by somebody who sounds like them. So, you know, they hear themselves in the story. But for kids who are not from that culture, it brings the story even more to life, because it can be difficult when, you know, we want kids to be reading about stories from other places, but it can be difficult for them with the proper nouns and with regional dialects that they can't look at on the page and hear in their mind.
Mm-hmm. Here's Neela Vaswani, and she's reading Malala's autobiography.
But there's a note of worry in his voice, as if he fears I won't be there to reply. Because it was not so long ago that I was nearly killed, simply because I was speaking out about my right to go to school.
Yeah, that's a beautiful sounding voice too. She's got a great voice. You brought one where Artie Johnson is reading a book called The Misadventures of Edgar and Allan Poe, The Pet and the Pendulum. This is Artie Johnson from Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In back in the day.
I wondered if you'd remember.
Yeah,
really interesting.
Yeah,
this is a cute series about two twins, Edgar and Allan Poe, and of course they're geniuses, and of course all sorts of macabre little things happen. But he's got that sort of dry voice. He does a real sort of noir sound, and it just really add so much to this story.
All right, here's Artie Johnson reading The Misadventures of Edgar and Allan Poe.
In mid-October, the Poe twins had been suspended from the entire Baltimore City School District on trumped-up charges. In the interim, they'd had amazing adventures.
That's really wonderful. Do you think there are certain kinds of books that work particularly well as an audiobook?
It really depends, and it kind of depends on the reader. It somewhat depends on the writing. I find books that have maybe a more fantastic setting. The How to Train Your Dragons books are great on audio, and that's partly due to the reader. Those books are read by David Tennant, who is Doctor Who, who was Doctor Who a couple of Doctor Who's ago. And sometimes these readers can really get the dialogue and create individual characters, even with a large cast of characters. Jim Dale was famous for that with the Harry Potter books. He's got like an army of people, and they were all vocally distinct. Other readers are not as talented at that, and it is better with description.
Yeah, but bottom line, there are some really solid research-driven benefits to kids listening to books as well as reading them.
Absolutely.
All right, Paula, always good to see you. We'll see you soon next time.
All right, thanks a lot.
Paula Willey is a librarian at the Parkville Kearney branch of the Baltimore County Library. She writes about literature for children and young adults at her blog, Unadulterated. She's also a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. We'll have a link to Paula's blog and to a list of the books that we talked about this morning at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1814, Kent County militia confronted and repulsed British forces at Cox Field near Fairlie on the Eastern Shore. American losses were slight, while the British lost 15 men, including their commander. We're back Wednesday. Hope you'll be with us.